Hey everyone, I want you to know how proud I am to welcome Hostetler Roofing as a sponsorship partner. I had the pleasure to meet with some of Hostetler's staff, and I could tell they really mean it when they say they're all about honesty, integrity, and accountability. They get it that contractors don't have the best reputation, and they want to change people's minds about that by setting an example. Everything Hostetler Roofing does is about taking care of customers. Whether it's a commercial or residential job, maintenance, repair, or a whole new roof. That's why they offer 5- and 10-year workmanship warranties on everything they do. Hostetler has a huge variety of roofing styles and materials available, and they're happy to help you with options to pay for their work. From affordable financing to applying for government grants. It all starts with a free inspection. Just call and ask, and before you know it, you'll get the best advice out there about your roof. Visit HostetlerRoofing.com or call 870-557-4797 to get started. And please mention you heard about them here. Hello and welcome to On the Line. I'm Carl Richter. April Mathis has earned a place on the list of most acclaimed artists from Texarkana. Born and raised on the Texas side, she has honed her craft as an actor for more than 2 decades. It paid off with 2 Obie Awards for her off-Broadway work, and now she is making her Broadway debut. Mathis plays Grace in The Piano Lesson, August Wilson's 1987 Pulitzer Prize-winning drama. She is part of an A-list cast that includes Danielle Brooks, John David Washington, and Samuel L. Jackson. We talked about her memories of Texarkana, her path to success, her part in the play, and more. Here's my conversation with April Mathis. Joining me on the phone from New York City, it's April Mathis. Hi, April.
Hello, how are you?
Great. Thanks so much for taking the time to do this.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's so great to talk to the home paper.
Yeah, I know you grew up here. Were you born here?
Yes, I was born in Wadley Hospital.
Ah, just a little ways away. What do you think about when you think about Texarkana?
I think about my family. I think about the Perot Theater, you know, Texas High, the State Line. I think about Central Mall and the fireworks behind Central Mall, you know. It's Spring Lake Park, mm-hmm. just the Robinson Road. I mean, the landscape and the landmarks in the community are just embedded into my subconscious. Like, you know, I find myself having kind of metaphorical, symbolic dreams that upon waking, I realize they are locations in Texarkana. Like sometimes I'll be at a literal crossroads and it'll be like the on-ramp to the highway from like Wake Village, crossing over into like the main part of town. Like that, when I wake up, I'm realizing like, oh, what I was looking at was like an aerial view of Texarkana. It's just so odd.
That's interesting.
I've noticed that the last few years, but yeah, it's in there, even though, you know, I haven't lived there for 20 some odd years. It's definitely still in me.
Yeah. Our places are a real part of us, and that plays into the play you're in right now. We're going to talk about that in just a minute. I read that you were involved in stuff like yearbook and band when you were here. When did acting come in?
Well, you know, acting was never an official thing. It was always kind of like just part of how I behaved at home. I was super into play. And, you know, my folks can tell you, you know, I had a tape recorder and I would just make up, like, play hooky from church and make up my own sermons and record those and, you know, make up TV shows, like, in the age of, like, Oprah and Donahue. Like, I'd host my own show with my sister as a two-year-old as my guest. And I had a Casio keyboard. I would write my own jingles for fake commercials, like, you know. It was just part of a really kind of heightened play. And, you know, my folks, you know, my mom would improv with me, you know, if we were making fun of, you know, somebody who was racist, and, you know, we would do that accent that we heard in the town, or, you know, like, it was just humor was a way to kind of look at life. And everybody had a sense of imagination. Like my grandfather would perform like dramatic texts in church, and, you know, we called them speeches, mm-hmm. you know, for Easter, but it was really just you know, reciting religious poetry or whatever. But it was a tradition of performance, and especially like growing up in the Black Baptist Church, there was a lot of oratory and performative tradition,
right.
that, you know, little did I realize was like an education, but just was woven into the fabric of my creative life. But, as far as school, I pursued those other things. I never was in I never did theater or drama because my electives were already taken up with other things. But, you know, of course, in hindsight, I'm like, I wonder what it would have been like if I'd gotten into those kinds of things earlier.
Yeah, it's really interesting. When did you first get on stage?
Oh, that would be in Austin, Texas, probably around 1999.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was a college student. And I had taken a performance studies class taught by this deaf queer performance artist, Terry Galloway.
Wow.
And it was cross-referenced with women's studies. So, you know, again, like, it was just as hard to get into the acting classes at UT as it was, you know, in Texas High. But this was like a kind of academic performance studies class.
Right.
And that class kind of encouraged me to pursue acting in the Austin community theater scene, which was really vibrant. There were a lot of theater companies and a lot of people performing original work. So the first thing I did was a stage adaptation of A Tale of Two Cities at the Vortex Theater.
Was there a light bulb moment when you realized, hey, I'm good at this, I could make a run at making this a career?
Well, career, I don't know, but I remember the first time I had like an honest acting impulse. Like, I remember there was, we had been doing the show, and it occurred to me in the moment during a performance, like, I think it's the speech that the hero gives is a far, far better thing than mm-hmm. I do. And I took off my hat and I placed it on my chest, and that was like, oh, that's good. That's good acting there.
Yeah, and that's not me. Know. That's the character, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I hadn't ever taken any acting classes and talked about motivation or whatever, but like I discovered that, and that was very exciting. And so, you know, I felt like before at home, I had just been kind of always messing around, and, you know, I would read plays with expression and have fun, but, you know, never really was sure whether I was like a really objectively good actor. Mm. And so that made me think, oh, wow, like I have some impulses. Like I like this. I want to have more discoveries. Maybe I'll have more discoveries.
Right. How'd you get to New York?
Well, so I started working in the Austin kind of experimental theater scene there for about a year. And within a year, I had worked at Zachary Scott Theater and kind of done everything that I had wanted to do and worked with everyone I wanted to work with. And a playwright whose play I had just done, Ruth Margraf, we had done the Southwest premiere of her play, The Crypitch Carols, with this theater company, Salvage Vanguard. Mm. And she had a sublet, or her partner at the time had a sublet in New York. And they let me rent out that sublet. And, you know, I was told when you moved to New York, you needed $3,000. You needed at least $1,000 for rent, $1,000 security, and $1,000 for the deposit.
Mm-hmm.
And or first and last month's rent and security deposit. That's what it was.
Right.
And so this sublet was like $700.
Huh.
And I didn't need that first and last month's rent. So I took my last paycheck from Publishers Resource Group, where I was working at the time as my day job, and took that paycheck and paid for that sublet. And so that was like my foothold in the city.
Interesting. And I guess you just started auditioning there, huh?
Yeah, I started working. The first play was at the New Eurekan Poets Cafe, a famous performance venue in the Lower East Side.
Yes.
Which mostly is for the Puerto Rican performing community, but they were doing a play there. And so that was the first thing I got cast in. And I started doing readings and workshops, and from there started to build up a network of people working in the New York downtown theater scene.
And since then, you've won a couple of Obie Awards for off-Broadway performances.
Yes. Literally two.
Yeah.
The first one was in 2015, and that was kind of like a catch-all. It was sustained excellence of performance. And so that was just kind of like a recognition of like the work I had done thus far over the years.
Hmm.
And then in 2020, I received an Obie Award for performance for my role in Tony Stone, where I played the title character. So that was a nice thing to get.
Yeah.
In the early throes of the pandemic, coming off of the last show that I had done.
Mm-hmm.
And not knowing when I was going to get to do theater again. So, yeah, that was really lovely.
So let's talk about The Piano Lesson by August Wilson.
Yes.
Tell me if you think this is a fair sort of broad summary of it. It's set in 1936.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about a black family who's on this sort of threshold between the past and the future. There's a precipitating event, a death, that causes the various characters to have to reckon with that and what it means. Do you think that describes it pretty well?
Yeah, I say, but the main thing is it centers around this family heirloom, which is
right.
The piano that is in the the family's possession, which is carved with the images of their ancestors by a great-grandparent who was enslaved. And the piano belonged to the white family that enslaved them. And it was rescued from that family because it was bought with the family members. They were traded for this piano.
Right.
And so the freed family members who were the descendants got this piano back and took it out of the house and put it in their own home, and died as punishment for that. And the conflict that the play centers around is the sister who wants to keep the piano in the family, and the brother who wants to sell the piano to get the land that belonged to the white family that owned the black family.
Right. And this piano, I've seen photos of the piano in the production you're in right now. It's very,
oh, great.
It's very beautiful.
Yes.
I watched the TV movie adaptation
night.
That one was done more crudely with the sculpture. But in any case, yeah, this piano is just this real tangible symbol of everything this family's gone through.
Yes, it has different depictions of marriages, births, deaths. It's a really kind of radical thing that this the great grandfather did at the time, was to take basically an assignment, like decorate this piano for the mistress because she misses these slaves, and he took ownership of it for himself, even knowing that he would gain no monetary value from it. It's a real act of resistance and reclaiming to take this object that was purchased with his family and make it embody his family and make it something that is, undeniably his work.
How did you get the part?
I'm sorry, say that again.
How did you get the part?
It was an offer that came to me right after I had done Tony Stone in 2019. I got a message that said all involved, including the producers and Miss LaTonya Richardson Jackson, who is our director, would like you to be a part of this piece. And it mentioned that Samuel L. Jackson, Danielle Brooks, and John David Washington, who's the son of Denzel Washington, had all been cast. And this is my Broadway debut. I've been working in the theater for 20 years, and I have auditioned for Broadway, but hadn't done any Broadway yet. And so this came as a straight offer to play Grace, who appears in the second act with Boy Willie and leaves with his friend Lyman. Mm-hmm. That's what happened.
And well, must have been over the moon.
It was really great. I had actually lost a really good friend of mine earlier that month, and I was reeling from that, and not knowing that we would be entering a plague in the new year, it just seemed like something really special to have with, alongside of like a new fresh grief, was like a promise of work, which I've always found really kind of deeply satisfying and grounding the work that I get to do.
Grace, it's a relatively small role in the play. What do you see as Grace's place in the story?
I think what Grace does is she brings the life of African Americans in this time period, in this very specific location, which is the Hill District of Pittsburgh, at, as you said, 1936. She brings in that nightlife and that spirit, and that consciousness, and injects it into the play, because what you have before that is the character Boy Willie coming from the South, and this piano, which is a relic of the antebellum South and the transatlantic slave trade, and the human cost and blood, and his sister Bernice talks about the literal blood in and on the piano. Mm-hmm. You have all that painful history of African Americans in particular, and the South. And then you have this Northern African American community that's thriving, that has joy and pleasure. There's jazz, there's, you know, cinema. Boy Willie's best friend Lyman talks about going to the picture show all mm-hmm. the time, and meeting women at the picture show. And so what Grace is, you see, whereas Bernice is this single mom who is widowed and has suitors but isn't really interested in pursuing marriage, and you know, is accused of being like cut off emotionally and maybe also sensually. Mm-hmm. And here you have a woman who is embracing sensuality, embracing pleasure, is not dour and, you know, stayed in her scenes. She comes in giggling, mm-hmm. you know, she mm-hmm. comes in dancing. She's full of life. She's wearing this vibrant, beautiful engine red dress that I get to wear. Mm. And as mentioned in the play, you know, she had on a red dress. And this woman who's this young, vibrant woman in her prime, who's full of life and unapologetic about that, in a time where even in the North, for somebody on the socioeconomic rung of American history, on the disenfranchised spectrum, could be seen as the most disenfranchised, and yet she has the most fun in the play and is the most free.
Does having less time on stage bring more pressure or less pressure on your performance, do you think?
I mean, I'm not playing the characters who spend more time on stage, so I can't speak to what that experience is about. Uh-huh. I mean, I know that it is exhausting in a different way, but I will say that I do exhaust myself, and I do feel a lot of pressure to make this character that we get two scenes with, to make her into a full three-dimensional person and not just the butt of a joke. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I'm working really, really hard to make her just as rich and vibrant, and to leave the audience with a sense of, who is this woman? How can we get to know her more?
Right.
Where's the Grace play? You know,
the sequel.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, and I've had friends, they're my friends, but still, I think they're discerning and honest with me. And they say, you know, we wish you were in the first act. So I want people to have that sense of like, Grace is memorable. Grace mm. is a presence. She's a force. She's got a point of view, and she's not just the object of desire, but she's the subject of her own desire and vibrancy.
Yeah. You mentioned the rest of the cast. Tell me what it's like working with them, especially such a big famous star as Sam Jackson.
Well, you know, they make it really normal to be in the room with them.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, you know, before the pandemic hit that I was going to meet Samuel L. Jackson on my birthday in 2020. My birthday is April 6th, and that's when we were going to start a workshop of this play before production that would have happened in the fall of 2020. And of course, that did not happen, so I did not meet Sam. And so when we were here for the first rehearsal of this production on August 15th, we had to do our COVID tests before entering the room, and, you know, they hand you the packet, and I was told, you know, oh, you can just go into this room. So I'm holding my COVID test, you know, which I'm about to put in my nose. And I open the door, and first thing, no mask on, Sam Jackson's face just right there.
Wow.
And so I had to take a moment because I said, I was not prepared to meet you yet, sir. I was ready to swab my nose. And he goes, sir, well, I guess I must be getting old, calling him sir. So, you know, he was just very, disarming right away. And he said, who are you? I'm April Mathis, I'm playing Grace. Danielle and I have mutual friends in the theater community. So she had heard of me. I know a lot of the people she knows. Of course, I loved her work on Orange is the New Black. John David had actually randomly worked with a friend of mine in Thailand recently.
Hmm.
And, he was lovely. And, you know, the first thing he said to me was, you know, I'm just here to learn as much as possible, because it was also his Broadway debut.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone was just really, LaTanya, you know, took me aside and hugged me and told me that she wanted to make Grace into a real person. And she had actually been corresponding with me a couple of times via email before the pandemic and during the pandemic. It felt very familial really quickly. And also the Jacksons and the Washingtons have had a long friendship. So LaTanya and Sam, they're married, by the way.
Right.
LaTanya and Sam have known John David since he was a child. So it felt very, you know, familial in that way. They have kind of taken him under their wing. And so I think this was a project that they really wanted to do with him. And you just had that family atmosphere. We would and still continue to have like prayer circles before rehearsals and now before the show. I mean, voluntary, of course, but it really is the experience that's closest to my Texarkana family life than that I've had since I moved to New York.
How long is the run? Are you going to be doing this a while?
Through January 15th.
Okay.
So that's a limited run for Broadway. It's 17 weeks. And I think that is due to everyone's very busy movie and television career schedules.
Right. So there's still time. If anybody here is heading to New York, to come check it out.
Yes, we perform on Christmas Day, so you could come for holidays.
What's next for you?
What's next for me? I am slated to do another play at the same theater where I performed Tony Stone at the Roundabout Theater here called Primary Trust. And that's supposed to happen next summer. And I just finished an independent film that is going to we have a rough cut of that is going to be submitted to festivals. So that will probably be coming out sometime next year. And in the meantime, I'm, you know, auditioning and trying to get some work after January 15th. So we'll see.
Well, we're also happy for you and proud of you here back home. And thanks again for taking a little time to talk to us. I think it's been really interesting.
Well, thank you so much. It's been my pleasure.
We'll see you later down the road.
All right. Thank you so much.
On the Line is a Texarkana Gazette podcast recorded in Star Bear Studio, right here in downtown Texarkana, USA. Follow On the Line on Twitter at OTLTXK and on our website, texarkanagazette.com/podcast. To support the show, post a positive review wherever you get your podcasts. The show is written, produced, and edited by yours truly, Carl Richter, and I'd love to hear from you. Email me at krichter@texarkanagazette.com. I'll see you next time on the Line.